This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. Many parts of the state are still grappling with very significant numbers of COVID-19 cases. And yet, there are still problems with testing and getting results quickly, though we've entered the sixth month of the pandemic. Even in places like Trinity County, with relatively few cases, there's a cause for concern. In today's show, we'll learn how to interpret coronavirus cases in the state, about the status of evictions in California, and if you need food or rental assistance, where to find it. That's all ahead. If you have questions or comments, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or head over to mynspr.org. For Thursday, August 13th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Since the pandemic began, COVID-19 testing in Trinity County has revealed positive cases in just the single digits. And because of this, the county has avoided being placed on the state's monitoring list for elevated disease transmission. But that low case number tells only part of the story. NSPR's Andre Bayek spoke with Marcy Jo Kudzel, Trinity County's public health nursing director. She explains what the numbers mean.
One of the things we ask our public to look at when they're looking at disease activity in the county and how to assess that is to look at not only the case rate, but also the number of individuals that have been isolated over time and quarantined over time, as well as those that are currently being isolated and quarantined. And the reason we do that is because there's not necessarily a direct correlation between the case number and the number of isolated and quarantined. And here's the reason for that. We can have individuals who've been exposed outside of our county and come back into the county. And because this is a statewide issue, we collaborate with other health departments. And so they're notifying us in the course of their contact investigation when they've identified persons that reside in Trinity County that may have been exposed. So then we quarantine those individuals. So you may have a higher number of quarantines for a case that isn't even in Trinity County. That's number one. Number two is we do have certain incidences. Say the perfect example for this happening with isolation is inmates that might be coming back as part of the early release or their normal release dates where they've been tested and their testing address is the county of the prison. We don't necessarily count those cases, but this particular case, it might be counted in another county, but those people are relocating back to Trinity County. And we will isolate them depending on their status.
You mentioned testing briefly. Regarding testing, I believe when we last spoke, there were efforts to perhaps get a mobile testing site to come through the county facilitated by the state. Are health officials comfortable with the number of tests being performed in the county currently?
Testing is not just the quantity, but the quality of testing and who we're testing. The numbers are sufficient to meet the state requirement for the percent of the population being tested. So we are testing significant numbers of people compared to what we were back in March and April. We did bring mobile testing here thanks to our partnership with the California Department of Public Health and their contract with the Vera Lee mobile testing site. And our team worked very hard and continues to work hard to ensure those testing sites are available every week in two different locations in the county. The challenge recently is the capacity issue, not just with the labs that are running the tests, but also with the delivery systems that must transport those specimens from rural counties to those labs. And so we're having a delay in the reports of those results, which can be problematic in that with long wait, we've had some that have been as long as 12 days. And we found in one case that by the time we got the result, their isolation would have ended anyway. So that becomes a real concern about being able to do contact tracing and contain any spread in people, their contacts to people who've been positive.
It sounds to me that Trinity County and officials there are taking many precautions and looking at their case numbers as perhaps not as rosy as it may seem. So you're taking these quarantine measures and isolation measures, and then testing delays also sound like a problem there. I guess I'm wondering, is Trinity County's case number an accurate portrayal of how the virus is behaving there?
You know, you look at from epidemiological purposes, tests being done and what the proportion of positives of those tests are. We're always looking at making our data better, really looking at aligning our data as things are changing and happening with what we're seeing. One of the issues that we're looking at is how to report testing when you may have duplicate tests. So people may have a test done more than once. And so it's the number of people that are being tested that we have to rectify and what the number of positives are against that. This virus, we say this over and over, this is so unprecedented because it's novel and it's not like anything we've seen in the context of planning for pandemics. The predictability of this virus is very difficult. There are things that we're learning. I heard someone say this, and the statement really does emphasize this issue as we're building the airplane as we're flying it. New information is coming in all the time about this virus. The thing I caution our population on is everywhere around us, cases continue to climb. Deaths continue to climb. And experts have stated, and rightly so, that this virus will continue to infect people until herd immunity occurs. Now, herd immunity occurs either through vaccine or by mimicking herd immunity by implementing those prevention strategies that we know to work. Masking, social distancing, limiting gatherings, staying away from high-risk entities like bars, sanitation, hand washing. The thing I kind of liken back to is Modoc County is probably more isolated than we are. And they recently had a case. And so the concept that this virus can move across borders and still infect people in remote areas is a concern. And our best hope at to continue to contain any potential spread is to adhere to those prevention strategies and ramp up testing and contact tracing.
When you look forward to the next month or so, what are the things that you'll be keeping an eye on related to the virus, potential problem spots or maybe origin spots?
We have been working. We have a multitude of task force in Trinity County. One thing we've learned is it's a collective effort, and we have begun to shore up plans with our jail to ensure that we test inmates as well as staff on a regular basis, test inmates that are coming into the jail and being released from the jail, working continuously with our hospital and our healthcare workers. Our schools will be reopening in Trinity County in the middle of August, and we have been actively engaged in our schools. They have a robust plan to try to prevent the spread in schools and protect their teachers and staff. Testing is a big issue. There's a requirement and a recommendation for specific entities to have regular testing. That's a challenge in this environment. We really need our state and federal government to help us ensure that we can get testing results back fairly quickly as school begins to reopen. The experts are correct. The concern is that the individuals interacting with our children have suffered tremendously. We all want them in classrooms. We also, though, want to protect the primary caregivers for some of our children that are over the age of 60 and are at risk for severe illness, as well as teachers and school staff and what that means.
That was Marcy Jo Kudzel, Trinity County's Public Health Nursing Director. The U.S. economy has pretty much been hobbled by COVID-19. 5 months in, millions of people have no paychecks, the temporary boost to unemployment has ended, and an unprecedented eviction crisis looms. Dan Lindheim is a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He was a World Bank economist, senior advisor to former Bay Area Congressman Ron Dellums, and city administrator of Oakland. NSBR's Mark Albert spoke with him about what could happen without an agreement on supplemental unemployment assistance and the need for a statewide eviction moratorium.
It's a humongous problem. It's only going to get worse as the various federal efforts to provide benefits to people are in limbo at the moment. With the suspension of the $600 and President Trump's executive memo, which is completely unclear whether A, it has any meaning, B, whether it's legal, C, by putting 25% of the $400 onto the states, and with most states probably not having the means to be able to cover that amount, unless anything happens at the congressional level and is made retroactive, that people are going to be even deeper in difficulty. Newsom estimated it'd be about $700 million a week for California. That's not money that sort of just sits there on trees. Everybody's already hurting because of the pandemic. I mean, most budgets, both at the local and state level, are upside down. So putting additional burden on these budgets just make things that much more difficult. It's really only at the federal level that this can be addressed, because only the federal government has the ability to create money. And the federal government doesn't have to balance budgets. Only the state and local governments have to balance budgets. So to put this additional burden on states is really almost an impossible burden for most states. And many states are already talking about saying, look, we can't even play.
The $600 additional weekly pandemic unemployment payments seem to have helped many people handle expenses while furloughed or laid off. Some Republicans opposing those additional funds said they were a disincentive to people taking jobs. But with much of the economy and businesses shut down and few jobs available, was that even a legitimate concern?
You know, for people who, let's say, were making minimum wage, that if they were getting the additional $600 a month, that would be a better deal for them. But most people prefer something stable that they know is going to be something they can count on, as opposed to a very temporary benefit that's coming from somewhere else. You know, there may be, in some cases, some short-term benefit, but most people who have studied this don't seem to think that that's really the case. I mean, I can imagine, you know, students who were working, let's say, and were getting minimum wage, and all of a sudden, if they were eligible, if they got the $600 additional dollars, that would be a good deal for them. But it's really only low-wage people which that would be the case. But I think most lower-wage people are already doing whatever they can to make ends meet. And so I think people are not going to sit at home if they have the opportunity to work. If this isn't continued and people don't have any income coming in or any substantial income coming in, that they're not going to be able to make any payments whatsoever. And if there's no moratorium and if landlords start moving on eviction, then people are going to be out in the street. Anybody who's dealt with homelessness and homeless issues knows that the best way to address homelessness is to keep people in their homes and to do whatever it takes to avoid people all of a sudden getting out in the street, because then it becomes vastly more expensive, at least from the public sector, to even begin to address any of those issues. So it makes no sense whatsoever to terminate the eviction moratorium.
The governor did try to protect small landlords, issuing a forbearance program for those with non-federally backed mortgages. I can't imagine that would help that many people. Aren't most mortgages, the vast majority of mortgages, federally backed?
I think somewhere on the order of 2/3 of them are. Mortgage forbearance is something that makes perfect sense. There's no reason to not have it just add months or whatever period of time to the end of the mortgage. And that really has fairly minimum impacts on the creditor in this particular case. And it allows the person who has the mortgage to pay just for a longer period. So it's not like they're paying less money, they're just extending it over a longer period of time. On the mortgage forbearance, there's the issue that many people pay both their property taxes and their insurance through their mortgages. And the question then is, what are the secondary impacts and the lack of property tax to state and local governments, in which property tax is a substantial part, especially for local governments. And then the question is, do people even know whether their insurance payments are being made and whether they themselves are insured? There are details in all of this that particularly concern me, that people may feel, okay, I have mortgage forbearance, but they may not realize that what the impacts are going to be on local governments, A, or B, just to make sure that they themselves are properly insured. And I hope anybody who is involved in any kind of forbearance checks on particularly whether they're insured.
Dr. Lindheim, you're an economist at the World Bank. You're also an aide chief of staff to Congressman Ron Dellums. So you have quite a bit of chops in this field. I imagine that you're sort of dream at night of what the proper solutions might be. What is a good policy response? What's a way out?
Well, I think there are two levels, at least two levels of responses. One is the appropriate response to dealing with the pandemic, because the United States has been a massive failure at dealing with that, and it's been a massive failure compared to almost any other country in the world. And so no matter what takes place, the United States has to, at a federal level, get its head around how to address the pandemic. Most countries have been vastly more successful in addressing this. So that's one set of issues. The whole idea that we can't afford to address the pandemic because of the economy is really upside down, because until we do address the pandemic, it's just going to have worse and worse economic impacts on the domestic economy. The second issue is there just has to be continued federal support for families who are particularly impacted by the pandemic. It's not something that can be handled by states or local governments. They just don't, A, have the funding sources, B, they don't have the ability to spend more than they bring in. And it's only the federal government who has that opportunity. And so to me, there just has to be a massive pandemic assistance bill at the federal level that continues for the duration of the pandemic. Because otherwise, there really is no option other than people being out in the street. The whole approach of the current administration has been to claim success when there were minimal kinds of good things happening, but basically devolve all responsibility to the states, which force states, A, to compete against each other for a whole series of things, and B, the states don't have the resources to address the needs of their people in this kind of situation.
Is there a way to equitably protect renters, get them the money to pay their landlords, and also to protect landlords so that they're not necessarily dependent on getting every penny every month out of all of their tenants?
If you continued the $600 a week payments, you could have some means of earmarking a percentage of that to pay rents. People are already paying a very high percentage of their incomes at the lower income levels for rent. And you could have some requirement that people pay a certain percentage of that. From the data that's out there, it's not like most people are stiffing their landlords. There was a census survey that said something like 75% of the people were making full payments. And obviously a percentage of the remaining 25 are making some kind of partial payments. But the best thing is to keep people having money coming in and then having them, you know, pay rent as much as they are able to do so. It's not one thing or the other. Until the pandemic is addressed, or even until the amount of disease is suppressed, that an awful lot of employers aren't going to be able to pay their workers. They're not even going to be able to be open. And so the first real requirement is to at least get the levels of disease down to manageable levels. And we had done that with the shelter in place, but we completely blew the opportunity to manage it once we started to open up. My own view about this is we have to go through this again, and whether it takes 6 weeks or 8 weeks, we need absolutely to provide benefits to people during that period of time. And we need to get the levels of disease down so that we can begin to manage it and then open up again with a much more careful opening process. But I don't think until we do that, or until there are vaccines, I don't think there's much hope for getting any of this, either the economy or the disease, under control.
That was Dan Lindheim, a professor of the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Coming up, how to apply for food, rent, and other assistance as the pandemic continues. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Learn more at raymondjames.com. And from iDrive, with Remote PC, providing remote access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere, assisting those working from home, and also enabling remote assistance for customers. At remotepc.com. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru through the Subaru Love Promise. Subaru and its retailers have donated more than $28 million to the ASPCA and local animal organizations. Subaru.com/pets. From Progressive Insurance, with the Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Indeed, offering sponsored jobs and tools like screener questions to help businesses find the high-impact hires who can make a difference. Learn more at indeed.com/high-impact. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. And finally today, because lawmakers in Washington have failed to agree on a new coronavirus relief package, people who've lost their jobs are being hit harder without the now expired $600 a week supplemental benefit. NSPR's Andre Bayek spoke with Ken McKell, Assistant Director for Butte County's Department of Employment and Social Services. He describes what his department has been seeing and what services are available.
When businesses first shut down, a lot of people came into our offices and were applying online. We probably doubled the amount of applications we were receiving on a daily basis. Since the benefits have ended, there's been a little bit of a spike, but it hasn't really jumped to where it was before. My guess would be the longer that this delay in passing something else goes on, that the higher our increase will be in applications. But I would imagine we would see more intake if they don't get something done quickly.
The people that you were saying at the beginning of the pandemic, what sorts of programs or services were they seeking?
Initially, almost everybody came in for CalFresh, which is the new phrase for food stamps. It's normal to see that kind of thing with when there's something like this that occurs. When we had the fire up in Paradise, the initial increase in applications was for CalFresh. Then after a little bit of time, there was an increase in Medi-Cal cases and then CalWORKs cases. So I would anticipate it be the same for this. Again, if they don't pass something to either extend those benefits or do something, that the CalFresh applications will increase first.
With COVID-19 cases being detected at a fairly high rate in Butte County, restrictions on businesses and perhaps their ability to hire or bring back people to work could be a reality for at least the near future. You mentioned some of them. Can you share the programs unemployed or underemployed people may be eligible for when it comes to, let's say, healthcare or food assistance?
There's really three major programs, CalFresh or the food stamps. Some of the folks, if they're working less than they were working before, some of the businesses are open, but they've got limited hours. So their staff might be working quite a bit less than they were working before, they would still qualify for that program. Medi-Cal is the other program that we have that's fairly common for people. If they've lost their health insurance, they could come in and apply for that. Covered California is also available for folks. Then CalWORKs is the cash assistance program for families. So that would be folks that have children under the age of 18 that they could come in and apply for. The cash program also includes CalFresh benefits and the Medi-Cal benefits as well. For single individuals, There is the General Assistance Program. It's actually a loan program, but it's for single individuals only. So it's a limited amount of cash and for a limited amount of time.
How can people get started on finding out which programs or services they may be eligible for?
Our offices are open, but we're kind of trying to limit the number of folks who are coming into the building for obvious reasons. There are lots of ways you can apply. You can go online, and if you go to seeforyourself.com, which is the letter C, the number 4, the word yourself.com, you can apply for any of those programs. You can do it online. You would never even have to come into the office. If we do an interview with you, it would be over the phone. It's very easy to do. If you're just looking to get CalFresh assistance, you can go to getcalfresh.org, so GetCalFresh.org, and it's only to apply for the CalFresh program. Again, it's online. It's very easy. I want to say 10 minutes or less to go through the process to get it started. Depending on your circumstances, we might do a phone interview, which isn't going to take very long, probably 30 to 40 minutes. But all that can be done online if folks would like to do that. We do have a fax number if people want to send in a paper application. That rarely happens. We also have a call center where if you call, you get a worker. That phone number is 1-877-410-8803. And you would actually get an eligibility worker who could walk you through the process, assist you with any questions, anything like that.
Are there any other programs or types of assistance that maybe your department doesn't handle, but you could refer people to, maybe a state program?
We have something called 211 in Butte County. It's a resource and referral site. You can call 211 and talk to somebody. You could also go online. Online there at helpcentral.org, and they have a whole database. You can click on what you're looking for. If you're looking for food, if you're looking for medical assistance, there's a lot of information on there. There's a lot of different places where you can get food assistance. It's a great way if you want to do it yourself. If you just want to call them at 211, you can do that, and someone will guide you through all the available resources in the area. That's probably the best one. And if you go there, it's going to connect you to everything else that is available. For example, Community Action Agency has a lot of food programs. They can connect you to all of those as well.
That was Ken McHale, Assistant Director for Butte County's Department of Employment and Social Services. And that's today's special coverage. If you have thoughts or want to share your experiences with the pandemic, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or our website, mynspr.org. This program was produced by Helen Barrington, Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Andre Bayek, Angel Horacha, Eric Rodeveal, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. I'm Matt Fidler, the technical producer at North State Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. Because of coverage of both the Democratic and Republican conventions, we'll be airing special programming on Thursdays at 5:30 for the next 2 weeks and Friday mornings at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.